Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts today are police reporter Naomi Martin. Hey, Naomi.
Hi.
And federal courts reporter Kevin Kraus.
Hey, Tristan.
You'll hear a new Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto. He's got some thoughts to share on Johnny Manziel. We'll talk about the former Texas A&M football star as well, but before then, we've got a few things on tap for you. We're going to talk later on with Dave Tarrant. He's a Dallas Morning News reporter, and Naomi here about a story they've been working on about a UNT student who was killed in a New Year's Eve, New Year's road rage incident. But first, we're going to talk about, Kevin, you had a couple of interesting stories, one of which you previewed last week. Could you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, it's about compounding pharmacies. A lot of people have never heard of these until recently. I hadn't heard about them until I started working on these stories. And they're specialty pharmacies, and they mix drugs tailored for certain patients. And some of them have come up with a new business plan to increase profits. What they're doing is soliciting physician investors in order to get more referrals. The doctors get paid investor dividends in exchange for writing prescriptions for the pharmacy's drugs. But that is a violation of the anti-kickback laws, which say doctors cannot accept money or any other financial rewards for prescription referrals. So the federal government is investigating these pharmacies across Texas and the U.S. in several states, including one in Fort Worth, which is the one I wrote about, for potential violations of this law. And the government wants to recover billions of dollars worth of federal health care insurance money that's been spent on these pain creams and other medications. The investigation is focusing on TRICARE, which is the military's taxpayer-funded health care system like Medicare. And the military stopped paying for the pain creams last year due to the enormous amounts of money being spent on them. And also there was questions about their effectiveness. I mean, if you get a sore knee, you know, you're supposed to rub this stuff on your knee, and it's supposed to magically cure the pain.
So this is like prescription cream, not like
exactly.
Icy hot, right?
Exactly. And there's proprietary ingredients in them. Nobody really knows what's in them. And they seem to have more of a placebo effect than anything else. And the military was kind of slow to catch on to this. But once they did, they basically pulled the plug. Now, after they did that, some of these pharmacies set up genetic testing labs. And what they're doing there, and the Fort Worth pharmacy was one of them, what they're doing there is taking blood samples and running genetic tests. It's supposed to assess a person's cancer risk and also determine how they, you know, which drugs they will tolerate the best. And they're allegedly paying kickbacks for referrals to the labs as well. And this is like a new area. It's unclear whether these DNA tests are effective. I mean, it hasn't really been completely vetted by the medical industry, the healthcare industry, but there's a lot of money at stake. And the most recent story I did was about the state of Texas and their attempt to crack down on this. There was a state law passed last year that went into effect in September, and it basically opens up their financial records for inspection by the State Board of Pharmacy.
What are these companies saying in response to these federal investigations?
Well, a lot of them, you know, they've hired lawyers. They say that it is legal, that it doesn't violate the anti-kickback law. There are various different arrangements that were set up to try to get around the kickback law. For example, a doctor could refer patients to pharmacy A, but actually have a slight ownership in pharmacy B, and both A and B are under an umbrella company. And so they feel that that's not violating the law, but that remains to be seen.
With the doctor's thing, you know, it's been a while since I've actually been to a doctor's office, but when I remember going, you'd see all the medical, you know, the prescription company gives them like pens, paper, you know, that kind of thing. Is that kind of stuff not allowed too, or is it just sort of more monetary kickbacks where they get, you know, you're afraid of going to your doctor and they say, you need a prescription for X, and then they get money for prescribing X?
Yeah, it's definitely more of that. I mean, it's a widespread, you know, practice for these pharmacy reps to come bearing gifts of some kind, usually minor things under $20. And even that's kind of, you know, some people may say that's kind of sketchy, but what we're talking about here is in some cases, physicians are earning more money from these referrals than they are, you know, from their normal practice of medicine. Because doctors
who make a lot of money,
exactly,
theoretically,
exactly, and these pharmacies are just their profits are sky high, and so if the doctors are getting a percentage of that, it's big bucks. I mean, six figure sums we're talking about.
Is there any way for the patients to like check whether their doctor is one of these?
That's a great question, and there's really not. I mean, the doctors are supposed to. They're supposed to disclose to the patients if they're earning money from these referrals. So the best thing you can do is pretty much to ask them, you know, are you getting paid anything for referring me to this pharmacy? And they they should volunteer that, really. But no, there's nowhere you can go online or elsewhere to find out, which is kind of scary. And that's why the government's really cracking down.
I guess it's another one of those uncomfortable questions you have to ask your doctor. But
exactly.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining us now in the studio is Dallas Morning News reporter Dave Tarrant, who has been working on a story with Naomi here, looking at the two lives of Sarah Mutz-Lechner, a UNT student, and Eric Johnson, a Marine, whose lives intersected in what police say was a road rage incident that left Lechner dead on New Year's. The story got a lot of attention. Dave, could you tell us a little bit about what you've been working on and the story that will come out, I believe, this upcoming Sunday?
Yeah, we wanted to look at the two lives of the people involved in this tragedy. Sarah Mutz-Lechner, a junior at UNT studying film, and Eric Johnson, a Marine at the time, and the two paths that they took to this point where their lives intersected in a kind of a tragic way.
Yeah, and they were both 20 years old, and it was really interesting talking to friends of both of them because we sort of reached a realization that they really could have been friends with each other if they had met under other circumstances. And so that was something that we found really interesting. And you know, they were both really into art and film and music, into like weird Japanese anime stuff. He was into like Japanese video games. And they both really liked to take younger kids under their wing. She had, you know, little sisters in her sorority, but also, you know, they had both been bullied in like middle school and high school. So they kind of felt like they needed to advocate for younger kids. And so that was something that was really striking. And something about Eric Johnson is that a lot of his friends were speaking out on social media after this happened, saying that this isn't the guy that we know and we can't see him killing someone. And so I found that really interesting. So I reached out to them and eventually got an interview with him. I believe we do have a clip that we can play, but it was interesting talking to his friends about how they, you know, never saw this side of him, and that he was the guy who was always trying to help other people better themselves. So when I was talking to him, I asked him how he felt about that night, and here's what he said.
For lack of better words, like, not because of, like, just what happened. Like, that's a up situation. I cuss a lot, but I'm not just... I don't know. It's worse in person than it is, like, if I write or other shit like that.
I
just gotta express myself sometimes. But, like, because the girl ain't mean or nothing. She cool. She nice or whatever. And then, like, after seeing everything that happened, like, the girl was, like, trying to do shit with her life. Like, she was in school. She was in a sorority. Like, she got her family and friends. Like, Being that I had to see her be taken from all that shit sucks. And on top of that, she's a female. I grew up, my mother, my grandmother, a lot of aunts, and I have an older sister. So I like, you know, different shit like that. And then I know what it's like to have people taken from me.
Now, there's almost a sense of detachment there, very scattered thoughts. What was that like talking to him?
He is extremely vivacious and vibrant. He was smiling a lot, not when he was talking about that, but in the previous moments. And he was, you know, you can tell that he has a lot of ideas, and he just was, you know, motioning a lot with his hands. He was standing up in a jail cell. You know, we were doing like a webcam type visitation. And it was just, it was weird because he didn't want to talk. So he had talked to his lawyer and he was like, my lawyer will kill me if I mention anything about that night. But he did answer that question. And so I think he was trying to say that he felt bad without really admitting any wrongdoing, even though the police say he did confess to them and apologize to her family and her sorority sisters. I think he now, after talking to a lawyer, probably is trying to stay a little more cautious when making public statements. So I think that might explain the detachment, or it might just be a coping mechanism after feeling so much remorse.
And Dave, this was a story that caught people's attention instantly. It just seems so brutal and callous and just strange that it happened to a UNT student at a New Year's Eve party like this. Could you tell us a little bit about how the experience has been for you working on this story?
Well, my son is 20, and actually he goes to UNT. He didn't know her, but he knew some of her friends. So it's been it's really hit home for me. And I talked to her parents, and when I did, I really felt a lot of what they were feeling, the kind of sadness they're going through. Her mom expressed, we were standing in Sarah's room, and Sarah's room is a reflection of her personality. It's full of the movies that she loves. She loves Quentin Tarantino. She loves Star Wars. She loved Harry Potter. She was into fantasy books and movies. And her mom was standing there and taking some comfort being in that room. But she also said it's like a big hole in their lives that they have to build around and that she feels robbed. And I could really feel that.
When we hear about, him, obviously hearing his voice is a little different than just seeing the person, on the page as this is the person who allegedly killed this young woman. And what's the goal here in trying to bring him, to give his side of the story, if that's possible?
Well, I think one of the things that we felt really strongly about was that we didn't want to just leave them as suspect and victim, that we really wanted to go beyond the caricature of that, of those two depictions and really bring them to life. This is a tragedy, and it's a tragedy for both sides. And I think even Eric's friends say that. Certainly her friends say that.
They do, just to say that they do also really stress that they don't condone what he did or allegedly did. They say that they don't, agree with it. It's 100% wrong. And it's awful, unforgivable. But the guy that they know, they just have to defend him because they know him really well. And they don't believe that it was like an evil side or something is how they're kind of trying to reconcile it. So, they do exactly see it as a tragedy.
Were there any interesting similarities between?
Lots. Yeah. I mean, Naomi has talked a lot about their interest in anime and film, but just their creative spark. The interest in doing things that are artistic.
And having a group of diverse friends. I think they both were the kind of people that had a large group of friends from all different kinds of walks of life and, spanning different interests and different types of people, too. Even though Eric was in the Marines, he had this whole fashion, community and music and like he was into sewing and cutting and sewing clothes. So,
she wasn't a girly girl, as one of her friends said. She had a lot of guy friends, but it was one of her sorority sisters who said, I think they might have been friends, and that's when we first started to really begin to realize the similarities between them.
What have you found out so far about what actually happened that night?
So we know a lot from the police report. But what we don't know, and the police report sort of explains that they were at this party, which is in the outskirts of Denton, and so it's this one road that you have to take back to town. They were stopped at a red light. Eric pulled up on the right side of Sarah. They were both driving cars that were full of their friends, and basically the guys in Eric's car motioned for the girls to roll down their window, and when they did, the guys in Eric's car said some sort of lewd comments about where are you going, like do you want to spend the night with us, something along those lines. And then the guys in the backseat of Sarah's car said something back, and then there were threats coming from Eric's car allegedly, and this is from the police report, saying, we're going to beat you. And then supposedly from the police report, Eric said, I'm going to shoot you, and then he showed a black handgun. And then as the light turned green and they drove off, two shots were fired, and one of them struck Sarah in the head, and the other one went into her back right door. And so Eric's friends are trying to make sense of this, saying, well, maybe Sarah's car, you know, the guys in Sarah's car said something that was just like so horrific to Eric and just made him snap. But we don't know what was really said. And so that's one of the lingering questions out there, because
and she, Sarah's mother, met with the guy in the back who allegedly said something, and he had gone to her and said he was really sorry about what happened. He didn't go into specifics, but he did say, you know, that he was feeling guilty, that maybe he was had helped contribute to this. And she said, oh, you should not feel that way. I mean, it's not your fault.
What has been the most surprising thing working on this story since you've begun?
Well, partly the fact that they were, you know, not identical in any way. They obviously came from different backgrounds. He's from a very urban environment in New Orleans, and then Fort Worth, and she grew up in a very small, very pretty town just east of San Marcos. But I think the fact that that they had so many friends who were so loyal to them, and there were two vigils for Sarah, one at UNT, which drew about 200 people, and another one in San Marcos, where she had gone to high school, which also drew about 200 people. Immediately on social media, his friends jumped to his, aid.
And you don't always see that with these cases. Like, you know, I've covered hundreds of murders at this point, sadly, and it's really rare to see anyone jump to their defense, especially anyone who's not family. And so, so that was really striking. But one thing also that I was surprised by, and I think the police were surprised by, was how good Eric's family is, that he comes from this very strict military mom who, made his friends show her their driver's licenses when they were driving to pick up her son, and you know, made them get their seatbelts on and was just very strict. He never had people over his house because she was so strict. And so when the police met with her, you know, one of the police spokesmen in Denton told me that they were really struck by his family, and they just are thinking maybe he just was like a good kid and came from a good family who just wanted to have this like rough guy image or something. So I was struck by that because usually you kind of see the like sort of absentee parents that lead to violence.
And they both had plans for their life. I mean, she had a whole bucket list of things that she wanted to do that her mom shared with me. She wanted to be a film director. She wanted to produce movies. He went into the Marines simply so he could get benefits so that he could go to college and pursue art studies.
Was there anything in his past that, you know, indicated that he could be capable of this? Or, you know, was there any violence in his past or any criminal history?
He doesn't have a criminal record from everything that I've learned. And he was voted like class clown in senior year. So he said that he was kind of known in school as like the loud kid. He moved around a lot. He went to a ton of different schools. And I think he just got really used to being like outgoing and loud and stuff. But his friend said that, you know, that he would get in the occasional fight, but it wasn't like he was a violent guy or a gangbanger or anything. So no, nothing really to indicate that. And I think that's why his friends were so shocked.
He had a Twitter feed. You might want to talk about a little bit about that, because it was sort of an alter ego where he showed off kind of a hip hop persona that was a little bit more.
Yeah. And his friend said that basically he adopted this persona in the last year, some point, called Santana Sage, where he would like rap under this name, and he would rap about guns and the streets and things that they didn't think he really did, but they weren't sure because he lives in Arizona now, where on his military base. So anyways, he had done this interview right after the shooting on New Year's, and basically in the interview, he was talking as Santana Sage, and he talked about how taking bodies is not cool, like telling people, you know, I've been a gangbanger, but now I'm not, and I just want you guys to know, like, don't wear gang colors. I've seen people get killed over gang colors and stuff. So it was almost like he was trying to act tough and street, but his friends are like, they don't think he really is. So there is that dichotomy.
That's a fascinating story, and we look forward to reading it on Sunday. Dave, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me on, Tristan.
last week we had some news in the football front. Johnny Manziel, who is a Cleveland Browns quarterback for now, a former Texas A&M football star, is under investigation by Dallas Police Department and possibly the Fort Worth Police Department over allegations that he hit his ex-girlfriend a couple of times, once at an upscale uptown hotel in Dallas and then on the road between Dallas and Fort Worth. Naomi, you've also been reporting on this story. What's the latest that you've heard?
So the ex-girlfriend filed for a protective order that she got in Fort Worth against Johnny. And so basically in that affidavit that she filed, which became public on Monday by her partners, NBC5, because it was filed under seal, she talked about, she described a really disturbing account of events where she said that basically she was out partying in Dallas. She met up with Johnny around 1:45 or 2 a.m., I forget, at Hotel Zaza uptown in Dallas. And they started talking in a hotel room about a girl who she said had been causing them problems in the past. Now, they broke up. She and Johnny Manziel broke up in December. So this is about a month and a half or so after they broke up. This is late January. And they start arguing. He pushes her onto the bed. This is all according to her, by the way. She said that he pushed her onto the bed. She was scared. She like tried to leave. He restrained her. He brought her down to the valet. There's this weird exchange that she describes with the valet where she says, please don't let him take me. And then the valet is like, I don't know what to do, and lets him literally, quote unquote, throw her into the car. And then they drive off, and he ends up, at one point she like gets out of the car and like runs across the street, tries to hide in the bushes. He finds her, like pulls her by the hair back into the car, and then drives her to Fort Worth. And on the drive, she's like, you know, crying and saying that, you know, she doesn't want to go or whatever, and he won't let her use her phone. And then he says at one point that he's going to kill them both. And so and then once they're in Fort Worth at her apartment, she claims that he refused to let her use her phone, and he actually smashed her phone. So then she tried to FaceTime her parents for help. And so they have this argument about whether she FaceTimed her parents. And then eventually she grabs a knife from the kitchen and tries to like get him, and he leaves. So that's the whole incident that she describes. And so the Fort Worth police are investigating whether any crimes were committed in Fort Worth. At first, Fort Worth and Dallas both said that they didn't have enough evidence to say that any crimes had occurred. But now they're both reopening their investigations and looking into whether the crime in Fort Worth could possibly be that he didn't let her call for help, which is unlawful. In Dallas, there's, you know, Tristan, I think you know more about where the Dallas police are at this point.
Right. The issue with them driving in the car is that you do need to have an offense location. So if they happen to be in Irving when that happened, that would have to be an Irving police investigation. You know, that was one of the issues early on with Fort Worth, is that they didn't have an offense location at first. Dallas did have one at the Uptown Hotel, but said they didn't have enough evidence to go forward. And that's the deal with these domestic violence cases, and this happens a lot, is the victim has to be able to talk to police first. There has to be a complaining witness. Under the Constitution, you have the right to face your accuser, or at least there has to be someone, you know, to corroborate the story that she gave to Fort Worth police. Just because she told Fort Worth police all this doesn't mean that there was a charge. Now, we found out Friday afternoon that she was over at police headquarters after they had announced the investigation was closed, so that obviously let them reopen it. The police chief said Monday that, you know, the thing is that we're going at the victim's pace. So it might be shocking to people because of the nature of the allegations that he hasn't been charged yet. But there's a lot involved in this investigation. You can bet that they are making sure that they catch every little detail in this one because it is such a high profile case.
And one other thing that I forgot to mention is that she claims that he at one point hit her while they were in the car in Dallas so hard that her eardrum got ruptured and she can't hear out of her left ear, at least temporarily. Her lawyer said that she should be getting her hearing back at some point.
Have you been able to locate anyone who's representing Johnny Manziel?
No, and he does have a lawyer listed in the sealed court records that we obtained. But that lawyer is a civil attorney based in Austin, and he didn't return any calls. I also reached out to his publicist in New York, who didn't return any calls, and his agent reportedly has released him at this point. So it's hard to get a hold of anyone who's really can speak on his behalf. We know that his dad did talk to us and say that he's concerned for his son and wanted him to go to rehab, and you know, he's concerned he's not going to live to see his 24th birthday.
Is that because of alcohol abuse, or is there also drug abuse?
You know, both are rumored.
Okay.
And you can definitely hear more from Kate Hieropoulos on I believe the podcast is called Ballsy. It's a sports podcast that we have as well. So I suggest that you go over there. Kate couldn't come in this morning, but she does talk about the Manziel case there, and you can hear more about all the concerns and on that show.
Okay. Now hold on. We have some sad news to report about this podcast. Tristan, I understand that you're leaving us. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I believe this will be my last show. I'll be taking a different position, but we'll leave this show in the trusty hands of Jen Emily, and you'll still be around, I understand.
Absolutely. I'll be here to carry the tradition forward. And thanks to you for setting this up, and you've done a great job being a steward of this. And we're sorry to see you go.
Well, I'm sorry to go, and I'm sorry that we're losing at least two listeners who are my parents. And but I'm sure we'll pick up plenty more along the way.
Sounds good.
That's all for us today. Mike Hashimoto will end things here in a moment. Thanks again to Dave Tarrant for coming in. You can read more on all you heard here today at dallasnews.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes. It comes out every Thursday. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer and sound engineer today is Brian Elledge. For Kevin Krause and Naomi Martin, I'm Tristan Hallman for, I guess, the last time. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
Johnny Manziel, meet Ethan Couch. Sports Day columnist Rick Goslin had the perfect description, football affluenza. The too-much-too-fast former Heisman Trophy winner from Texas A&M is still regressing from his Johnny Football fame. The question isn't whether the Dallas Cowboys or any other NFL team will gamble on his talent, however tarnished. The question should be whether he can stay out of jail long enough to even try again. Having wasted a number one draft pick, the Cleveland Browns are through with him. The Dallas police aren't. Manziel's former girlfriend, Colleen Crowley, told a disturbing story in getting a judge to issue a restraining order against Manziel. And for the record, restraining orders should serve as warning signs to prospective employers, even Jerry Jones. She said Manziel tossed her by the hair, slammed her into two different cars, and slapped her so hard she can't hear out of one ear, all in one crazy night from uptown Dallas to Fort Worth. And call that what you like, but don't forget it's also against the law. Manziel's dad said he fears the former Johnny Football won't make it to age 24 if he doesn't get help. And that's not football fear, that's real life fear.